They developed great powers, the power of will over matter, so that they were able to influence and control nature and events. In the end, they found the ultimate key, to dispense with their physical bodies altogether and become intelligences free from the shackles of time and space, to integrate finally into one great universal intelligence. This great force was then able to influence and bring order into the whole universe, and where life was most prolific and creative, it steered the evolution of man in their own original image. Man, wherever he developed, could not help being aware of this influence and called it by all sorts of names and different religious groups, but the wand and the wizard is the same. Men touched by the current strives to overcome death and join the heavenly force, constantly charging and revitalizing this cosmic battery so that its power remains everlasting. The universe is full of planets sustaining higher forms of life, millions in the galaxies, thousands in our own, where man is growing in various stages of development, some like yourselves in the early stages and some close to the very source of the Creator. Man was given the gift of tapping this source. Whenever man cries out for help, he appeals to the original promise, to Jehovah, God, or whatever he has come to call him. His prayers and collective willpower are the essential link to the source, and when it is ignored, man sinks to his lowest level. There is no personal God who rewards or punishes each individual. It is a far more exciting and grandiose concept than that. The gift gives man incredible potential for both good and evil, since within the source itself there are memories of man's weaknesses and evil, and man was given the choice to be Cain or Abel. There is nothing in this concept of God to offend any religion, and, indeed, it does not radically contradict any of the great religious books. There are many different paths leading to the top of the spiritual mountain. Only the words are different. You talk about God, miracles, life after death, heaven. Why God gives his grace and gifts in profusion to some and withholds it from others remains a mystery, but faith and trust remain essential to divinity. God provides enough evidence through his emissaries and their power of the miraculous to encourage man in this faith. What happens to the spirit when the physical body decays? Do all live on after death, even the little dead babies and the mentally afflicted? This remains another of God's mysteries, although there are clues. In Christianity, Christ said it was no easy matter to achieve everlasting life. It was no automatic right. Divinity has to be earned and depends upon man's own willpower and spiritual recognition of God's existence, however weak. After all, Christ thought the thief on the cross was worth enough to justify redemption. There are those, however, who have rejected God's touch, and to these mindless creatures life becomes an automatic process. These are the takers, never the givers, the destroyers, never the creators. In their case, almost as soon as the match was struck, they blew it out. They have no part in the eternal plan but pass through it sightless. The plan is a great one, requiring all sorts of spiritual talents to fulfill, and many seeds and crops are scattered over the fields of the universe. As long as the search and desire for truth lives on, the seed ripens and matures, but when it does not, then it withers and dies. I have tried to give you a glimpse of the great concourse of space, because it is against this background that you should consider its exploration and its explorers. There are differing views and theories about the objects you call flying saucers. There are those who would have them traveling along the trails of space to deliver prophetic messages of nuclear doom, or those who see them as a substitute for a tribal god. There are the fiction writers who portray their crews in every horrible guise, invading and pillaging the world. But in reality, they are none of these things but like yourselves, inhabitants of a planet exploring the outer islands of their galaxy. You may well ask, why come to Earth at all? The answer is that this traffic is only a thin trickle in the vast highways of the universe. The Earth, after all, is a galactic backwater inhabited by only half-civilized men, dangerous even to their own neighbors. However, that does not stop explorers wishing to find out more about Earth, just as your own people traveled to some particularly uncomfortable and dangerous spots in your own planet. Why, you may say, don't they land and make contact? Most of these vehicles are robot-controlled, space probes monitoring what is going on. Some are manned in order to oversee the whole program and to ensure the probes do not land or crash by accident. They must also ensure that evidence of their existence is kept away from the vast majority of Earth's population. You must be well aware of the damage which your own explorers have done by appearing and living among simple tribes, often leading to a complete disintegration of their society and culture as happened to the Indian and Eskimo. Such impact is far too indigestible and only the most developed societies can cope with such contact. Imagine what would happen if the headlines in the world press announced the arrival of a spaceship with a mission of space people. Apart from the psychological shock that there actually were other races far superior to any developed society on Earth, there would be complete panic about the motives of such an invasion. There is little doubt its crew, if you could catch them, would be subjected to the most humiliating interrogation and treatment. The knowledge you might acquire through contact and communication could have effects as disastrous as the so-called benefits of civilization had on the Indians and the Eskimos. This knowledge must come slowly to those most able to assimilate it in the fullness of time. The basic principle of responsible space exploration is that you do not interfere with the natural development and order of life in the universe any more than you should upset or destroy an ant-heap or beehive. Man has a lot to learn before he embarks on deep space travel. If you were ready now, which you are not, you would only approach other inhabitants with the deepest of suspicion, inflicting your weapons and diseases upon them in the same irresponsible manner that you are busily destroying wildlife on Earth. You will have to grow a lot older and learn how to behave on your own planet, if indeed you do not blow yourselves up between times, before you are ready for galactic travel. Since time immemorial there have been tales of vessels coming out of the sky bringing strange visitors. Observers do come among you and make contact on a very selective basis where they judge that such contact could not harm either party. These observers have studied the Earth for a long time. With advanced medical science they have been fitted with the right sort of internal equipment to allow their bodies to operate normally until they leave. It is not very difficult to obtain the right sort of clothes and means to move around quite freely. Your own explorers will appear enormously cumbersome in comparison, but then at first they will be operating in the very hostile environments within your solar system. The observers are not interested in interfering in your affairs, but once you are ready to escape from your own solar system, it is of paramount importance that you have learnt your responsibilities for the preservation of life everywhere. It is equally important that other planetary travelers and inhabitants know something about this outer island, its society and intentions. While you are still far away from traveling in deep space, such contacts will be infrequent and must be conducted with great secrecy. Life in your own solar system is rudimentary and you can do little damage. But once you discover the existence of higher forms of life and intelligent men, then the dangers will arise through your own fear and misunderstanding. The observers have very highly developed mental powers, including extrasensory, thought reading, hypnosis and the ability to use different dimensions, since all parts of the mind and body have not necessarily evolved in exactly the same fashion. They do not use weapons of any kind and rely solely on their special powers to look after themselves. They make contact only with selected people where secrecy can be maintained. In the loosely knit societies of the Western world, particularly in England and America, it is fairly easy with the help of friends to do this, but not in police and dictator states. It was what Janus had left unsaid that was fantastic. He had subtly separated himself during the conversation to leave me with the impression that he was not one of us, gradually insinuating that he was an observer. His personality was so powerful and hypnotic that already I was wondering what to do about him. Janus, once more read my thoughts correctly. Because what I have told you is entirely foreign, you are sensing danger. You are wondering who or what I am. At this juncture he stopped and I felt that was all he had to say. I thanked him and said I would have to think about his request as I was not in a position to promise anything now. He showed no sign of disappointment at my apparent lack of enthusiasm, and as I was clearly expected to leave, I did so with brief goodbyes. I spent the next few days puzzling over this very strange encounter. It would not have been so difficult had Janus been easily recognizable as a crank, but he was not, and there was much of what he said which made sense. What I found too difficult was the suggestion that space travelers had landed and were mixing with us. Authors like Adamski had already written about meeting people from flying saucers and flying in their machines, but I was quite aware that the cult had attracted all sorts of charlatans. What was Janus? Was he part of an elaborate hoax or plot? Was he a teacher, an imaginative prophet of the future, or what he had insinuated, an observer? Whatever else he was, Janus left me with the impression of a force to be reckoned with. He appeared to know a great deal and spoke with authority about space technology. If he was part of any kind of plot, it was my duty to report the meeting to the security authorities, particularly if it had anything to do with the royal family. I wrote a report of my meeting and conversation with Janus and gave it to Boy Browning to read. By this time Boy had become interested in the more esoteric side of flying saucers and was very keen that we should both meet Mr. Janus again. But I was not so sure. At any rate, I rang Mrs. Markham several times during the following few days but got no answer. So I eventually contacted General Martin, who suddenly became distant and evasive. Mrs. Markham had gone away. No, he did not know when she would be back. I did not like leaving the matter like this, so I finally went round to Mrs. Markham's flat, but there was no sign of any life in it. I inquired of her neighbors on the floor below, but all they knew was that she had appeared to leave in a hurry. The curtain had dropped. Had Janus sensed that I was in two minds about informing the security authorities of my meeting? I never saw General Martin, Mrs. Markham, or Janus again. I wrote this record of my meeting at Smith Street immediately after the event and quote it verbatim. The episode did focus my mind on two great puzzles, the nature of God and the existence of UFOs and other phenomena. Since my escape from the sea, I had become a believer in God and the continuation of life after death. The experience had given me a much greater consciousness of the conflict between the great forces of spirituality and materialism. I felt strongly that God had tried to smooth my passage from this world to the next by dispatching three companions to accompany me on the journey. The mystery was why the journey was interrupted. Perhaps, within sight of the promised land, God had decided that I was not ready to face final judgment. Thereafter, I have never been afraid of death, only of the indignity and pain of the act itself. Until I met Janus, my concept of God was biblical. I could only imagine him as a father figure, dispensing gifts and punishment according to the behavior of his children. I avoided the question of who he was, where he came from, and why he should concern himself about a little provincial corner on the edge of nowhere. But Janus's explanation of the beginning and God as universal made sense, with all life evolving from the same origin and same materials. Even such a serious scientist as Crick, one of the discoverers of genetic structures, seriously put forward the theory that life did not originate on Earth but came from outer space. Nothing in the universe is ever destroyed or disappears without trace. Nature permits no extinction, only transformation. I became much more at intellectual peace with the concept of God as a universal spiritual force without shape or habitat, a cosmic battery, if you like, from which man could draw the power to charge himself, but a battery which also required constant charging by man's own spiritual fuel. This seemed to fit the historical pattern that when man was at his lowest spiritual ebb, the current was weak, but at his highest peak the light shone brightest. The idea of universal man and universal God necessary to each other is appealing, God needing man to maintain his own power and man needing God's power to attain his highest spiritual values, creating his greatest works as acts of supplication and praise. I felt this strongly during the war, when the light of sacrifice to overcome evil shone brightly, but since then, as the force of materialism became stronger, the light has dimmed and the vision of the ultimate horror becomes sharper. Men can only pray for a change of heart before it is too late. And more sightings. Over the next few years, the subject of UFOs continued to haunt me, and the reports of sightings were legion, sometimes flaring up like an epidemic only to die down again. It is perhaps worth repeating some of the more dramatic ones. In the past weeks, UFOs have been reported over Stonehenge and Shepton. Two policemen spotted an object last Thursday. Leaving their patrol car, they saw the saucer-shaped object with a dome on top in the sky near Wilton. A photograph of a flying saucer, claimed to be the most authentic so far, has been taken by two young women while motoring in West Waterford, Era, on Boxing Day. Three photographs of a flying saucer taken near Detroit last week by two youths are being studied by American Air Force investigators. One expert said that the pictures were apparently authentic and bore striking similarities to other reports he had investigated. Seven Coast Guards reported seeing a giant cone-shaped object hovering at about 15,000 feet. As an aircraft approached, it climbed to 20,000 feet and flew away. A senior RAF controller at Plymouth said, "We reported all the details. I cannot tell you where the aircraft came from, and you will have a job to get anyone to admit that any was sent up. I understand the UFO was also tracked by a radar." Mysterious flying objects, many described as starry crosses, were reported yesterday over wide areas of southern England. Crews of four police cars in different parts of Sussex made independent reports of a bright moving object. A retired wing commander said he saw four moving lights in formation over Hampshire. They were similar to the starry crosses chased across Devon by the police. Wing Commander Eric Cotts, 56, of Penton's Paddock, Hyde, saw seven brilliant lights while driving at night to Fording Bridge, Hants. They were 3 miles away, flying at treetop height, flying in a V formation. After about 3 minutes, they broke off and three went away. They just faded. Then the other four formed a perfect formation, just like a plus sign or cross. They were certainly under some sort of control because the formation was so tight. Eric Cox had been my wing commander in charge of the technical wing at RAF Wattisham and was totally reliable. The official explanation given was that the RAF was carrying out flight refueling exercises that night. I spoke to Eric Cox about the objects, and he said, "Whatever flight refueling, and, from my Air Force experience, I have no idea what they were." In 1967, Time magazine published an essay entitled "A Fresh Look at Flying Saucers," which summed up objectively most of the theories and conclusions reached up to that time on the subject of UFOs. It concluded, "The most telling argument against the reality of UFOs is that no proven physical evidence or hardware has ever been found to support the saucer's existence. And although astronomers photograph the sky incessantly, no UFO has left an image on their photographic plates." Despite the lack of such evidence, many scientists favor the continuation of UFO investigations in the hope that they will lead to new discoveries about man's environment, while clearing up the uncertainty about saucers. But even after the most rigorous examination by contemporary science, it will be difficult to prove beyond doubt that there are no extraterrestrial saucers. Says astronomer Hanek, "There is a tendency in the 20th century to forget that there will be a 21st century science, and indeed a 30th century science, from which vantage points our knowledge of the universe may appear quite different. We suffer, perhaps, from temporal provincialism, a form of arrogance that has always irritated posterity." Janus could have written quite large slices of that article. An official report, also published in 1967, stated that out of 6,000 reported sightings of UFOs, 2% remain inexplicable. That may seem an insignificant figure, yet, in numerical terms, it means that 120 of those sightings could not be given any rational explanation. In the same year, the Daily Express published a report that the Soviet Union had established a scientific mission, headed by an Air Force general, to investigate all corroborated sightings of UFOs. More recently, in October 1983, The Sunday Mirror reported that the well-known broadcaster David Jacobs and two prominent politicians, Shirley Williams and Jonathan Porritt, had described how a brilliant ball of light had crossed the path of a car in which they were traveling to London, at a height of about 250 to 300 feet, and then disappeared. This story produced a flood of similar reports from as far away as Devon. Neither the Ministry of Defence nor any air controllers could offer an explanation. They were described as being baffled. The paper concluded that this could only have been the flight path of a UFO. In 1969, I was posted to the Ministry of Defence as Assistant Chief of Air Staff Operations, responsible to the Vice Chief of Air Staff for the day-to-day management of our air operations worldwide. The Air Force Operations Room, AFOR, was responsible for collecting and presenting all information necessary for the conduct of operations and reported directly to me. There I discovered a rich vein of UFO reports in the form of an annex to a standard operating procedure, SOP, where every report of a UFO, from whatever source, was logged, examined and filed. Those which might have either public or political repercussions came to my desk. They seemed to arrive in batches. However, despite the very large number of incidents reported, the source and identity of the UFOs remained as mysterious and elusive as the other phenomena which have attracted public and scientific interest over the years. These include the Loch Ness Monster, the Yetis or Abominable Snowmen, the extraordinary report dated 1855 of the mysterious footmarks left in the snow over a wide area of Devon, and something very much of our own time, the completely inexplicable loss of ships and aircraft in what is now known as the Bermuda Triangle, the solution to which, despite massive air and sea searches and intensive scientific research, remains a complete mystery. No wreckage or human bodies have ever been recovered from the area. All these things have one common link: in the endless game of hide and seek they defy capture. Suppose we are actually living in a multidimensional time track within the same space, including a young primeval world, our own and a much older world with advanced technology, all aging and developing side by side, conscious and sometimes stirred by the presence of the others, strange ships in the sky, images of ancient creatures, the impudent antics of poltergeists and strange noises like the creaking of bedsprings from an empty room. These time tracks spin around like separate grooves of a gramophone record, each playing a different score until given a sudden jolt when the needle jumps a track, imposing for a very short period an unintelligible tune upon its neighbor before being returned to its own groove again. What causes the jolt is unimportant, possibly some electromagnetic charge, so that, under special and localized circumstances, images of the other worlds break through, leaving prints for the briefest space of time: the monster in Loch Ness, hairy creatures in the frozen waste, strange flying ships and machines. And, conversely, ships and aeroplanes disappear from our own space without trace, perhaps all ending up in some cosmic dustbin. Chapter 11. The Corridors of Power. So I left this tall and stately room with sadness and saw ahead of me a long corridor running down the back of the house, fitted, at first, with quite ordinary bits of furniture, bookcases and the like, but towards its end filling up with more substantial pieces. By the time I had completed 7 years as an equerry, I had climbed to the dizzy rank of wing commander. In 1955 I had to make a decision about my future. Either I returned to the RAF before it was too late, or I became a permanent fixture in the palace. The final choice was mine alone, and no one exerted any pressure on me to leave, but there were other personal factors which influenced me. My marriage was breaking up fast, as indeed was Michael Parker's. I decided therefore that it was time to leave. Michael Parker resigned about a year later, and General Boy Browning retired shortly afterwards. So over a period of about 2 years, Prince Philip had perforce to choose a completely new team. Returning to the RAF was no easy matter. I suppose I had basked in my master's glory so long that I had become accustomed to the role of a minor deity. I had also become used to dealing with various agencies at the highest level. If I rang the chief of defense staff, a minister or chairman of a major company, I was put through to them immediately and, frankly, over the years I had come to neglect my contemporaries. When I left the palace, the brass dropped me like a hot brick, while some of my old friends took the opportunity to kick me hard in the crotch. At first I felt very isolated, neither palace nor RAF. Without realizing it, I had become part of a totally different culture. My job had taken me over and I had become completely absorbed in it. The palace had fashioned a cozy cocoon around me, sheltering me from the normal vicissitudes of everyday life. When you wanted something done, hey presto, it happened like magic. The name of the Queen or Prince Philip opened doors normally locked to more humble subjects. I sometimes felt I had done it all before. The palace and the people in it were so familiar that in some previous reincarnation I had served as a courtier. It had become increasingly difficult to move from the palace back to a small house and all the horrid chores of domesticity. The differences were too great. Gradually the split between my working environment and my home life had widened. I had enjoyed working for Prince Philip. He worked tremendously hard himself and expected his staff to do the same. He was always direct and to the point, and his nautical training shone through all his actions. He occasionally became irritated with officialdom, and this had been particularly the case over his flying training and over dealings with the pompous air marshals who had long since given up any idea of flying themselves. They did their best to restrict his flying, however. According to Basil Boothroyd's book entitled Philip, I became a pompous air marshal myself, since he wrote, as a wry passing note, Peter Horsley, the squadron leader equerry who was so much on the side of the angels, is now an air marshal at the Ministry of Defense. I can't believe it, he told Parker when they recently met I'm an airship. But the wryest part, perhaps, is that Horsley is now one of the men earnestly wrapping protective cocoons round Prince Charles and his Queen's flight Bassett. What a snide remark. I had nothing whatever to do with Prince Charles' flying training, as I was at the time Assistant Chief of Air Staff, Operations. After I left I was invited back to the palace frequently to be greeted like the prodigal son, recognized by a smart salute from the policeman on the gate, entitled to use the privileged privy purse entrance, respectfully greeted by footmen and pages, confidently using the household cloakroom to park my overcoat, boisterously welcomed by the other equerries and household staff, and finally invited to whiskey and coffee in the equerry's room. Gradually, with the passage of time, this privileged position disappeared as old friends themselves left, retired or just died. Memories dimmed and I became just one of the crowd on the outside. But my time at the palace had a profound effect on my life afterwards and made me a much more complete and confident person. Fortunately, I still had one or two good friends in the Royal Air Force, who saw me safely back into the service via the Flying College at Manby. I had had the determination to keep up with my jet flying while I was doing my royal duties, and so excelled in my flying exercises on the Hunter and Canberra that at the end of the course I was given command of No. 9 Canberra Squadron to gain experience before, hopefully, getting the command of a prestigious V-Bomber Squadron, then the height of any Air Force officer's ambition. I entered Bomber Command at the height of its power with a formidable force of Vulcans, victors and valiants capable of carrying nuclear weapons, augmented by a force of about 250 Canberra light bombers with a conventional capability. I was posted to RAF Binbrook, which had a total force of 60 Canberras. Eventually the Canberra was given a nuclear capability with the low-altitude bombing system, LABS, or the Madman's Loop. This involved flying at 300 miles an hour at low level, pulling the aircraft up and at the top of the loop releasing the weapon and rolling out in the opposite direction. The Americans had been trying this out in B-57s until the wings of an aircraft were torn off. The technique had been picked up by the Royal Air Force. I often wondered how the Canberra stood up to the maneuver, but as far as I know no wings came off. After 6 months or so on 9 Squadron, Far from being posted to a V-bomber squadron, I was sent back to the flying college at Manby as senior instructor.